fact that there was some reporting, I think, by The Guardian and BBC that I heard today that the people stirring up a lot of trouble and saying things outside the gates at Columbia were tied to the Proud Boys, that there were people who attacked the protesters at UCLA so violently and who had ties to Trump rallies. And I think it's deeply ironic, deeply ironic that the House Republicans who supported the January 6th assault on the Capitol, in which people were wearing Camp Auschwitz shirts and shirts with a logo that says 6 MWE, 6 million wasn't enough, and that they have become the defenders against anti-Semitism. I heard nothing. There were Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, and Jewish chaplains at our protest. The students were singing, they were chanting. Yes, there was some of the River to the Sea chant that many Jews find so offensive and believe is a call to genocide. I accept the interpretation made by my Palestinian colleagues and students that this chant is about equality from the River to the Sea and freedom. So I don't see any anti-Semitism, and you should know that many Jewish faculty at Dartmouth signed a letter insisting that the president not speak in our name and not use anti-Semitism to rationalize bringing these violent forces onto our campus.
And Professor, your message to the students who've led and organized these peaceful protests for months, despite all of this repression?
Well, our students are holding another rally today on one of the parts of the campus we're not banned from, which is the grass in front of the library. And I think their bravery is tremendous and it's inspiring. And they really feel like this is the moral issue of their time, that there's a genocide going on and that they can't ignore it. And again, I have colleagues at Columbia, colleagues at UCLA, and in many parts of the country who have been part of the, not part of the encampments, but have visited the encampments, have spoken to the students there, have not felt threatened, have not felt anti-Semitism. Certainly, at Dartmouth, we didn't. And there's a very powerful open letter from a Christian pastor who was there, who's saying the same thing. So stop weaponizing anti-Semitism. It's offensive and it's wrong.
Finally, Professor Ehrlich, how are you right now, having been beaten to the ground? And also, you're banned from your campus where you've taught for over 30 years, parts of it?
Yes, I was initially, as a condition of my bail, banned from the entire campus, but the college insisted that was a clerical error and gave lie to their argument that they can't get charges changed or dropped by calling the local police department and getting them to change my bail so that I can teach. So I can now teach, but my building is on one of the streets that I'm banned from. So I was having to run up the street yesterday in sunglasses really quickly. Trying to get to my class, and not get arrested. It's ridiculous. And the green is the very center of our campus. We all cross it many times a day. My kids grew up playing on the green. The idea that we can't have access to the beating heart of our campus is offensive again. And just gives a sense. The president makes this argument that she's trying to ensure that the green is open to people with all views, and that the five tents and 10 students who were camped out there would make the green a place that only people of one view could be. Honestly, I think that's what they did by making us frightened. I'm still hurting. I have nerve damage in my wrist. I have an injured shoulder. I have bruising and swelling, and it's very scary. And I'm getting better, but it's crazy that I should be in this position for trying to protect my students. And I say the same for other faculty who are out there, including Chris McEvitt, my colleague on the faculty, who was also arrested and also harmed.
Annalise Ehrlich, we want to thank you for being with us, Professor of History, Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, former Chair of Jewish Studies at Dartmouth College, where she's taught for more than 30 years. Professor Ehrlich, among dozens of students, faculty, community members arrested at a Dartmouth encampment. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
a.m. My name's DJ Tony Tunes and Anthony Cacciato, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Well, I did accidentally give you my secret identity there, but, you know, it's all good. I mean, do a little bit of both. Do a little bit of the music, do a little bit of the talking. I'm sure if you listen to both, it's a little obvious I sound exactly the same there. But just before we do get into the mix of things here, wanted to let you know that everything that's said on this program today is just the views of myself and my guests and not necessarily those of WRCT or its members. So, without further ado, I'm going to run right into this episode of The Angry Young Man, where today I am very glad to have a friend of mine, the Map Boy, as he was very affectionately called a couple of years back, but also Student Senate President, as of not too long ago, not the case anymore.
Only for six more hours, and then I'm free.
Six more hours!
Six okay. more hours.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is Kyle Hines, the lame duck Senate president. I'm sorry, that's a little... No,
it's accurate. I'm a lame duck.
Yeah, no, but, yeah, welcome to The Angry Young Man, another Billy Joel appreciator, who, for those of you who are not Billy Joel fans, this is named after a Billy Joel song, The Angry Young Man, the song that we start off with every single Thursday. But yeah, welcome to the program, Kyle.
Thank you, DJ Tony Tunes. It is an absolute pleasure to be on.
All right. Yeah, no. It's Anthony Cacciato for the purposes of the show.
Is it Mr. Cacciato? We'll go with that one.
Mr. Cacciato. Very,
Mr.
very
Cacciato,
formal.
The angry young
very,
man.
Very formal of you there. So the thing we're going to talk about today, you know, we were talking a little bit about what we wanted to do, and we ended up settling on a wonderful, very relevant piece of current affairs, foreign aid. For those of you unaware, over the weekend on the 20th, the House of Representatives passed several bills, three of them being aid packages to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, respectively, amongst a myriad of other things they passed that day. But a lot of people very happy to see that Mike Johnson delivered on that, working with a coalition of Democrats and Republicans. But a lot of Republicans also not too thrilled to see more American taxpayer money sent abroad, especially without oversight. So, I mean, this is kind of your bread and butter here, Kyle, from my understanding.
Not quite my bread and butter, but I got some thoughts on it, and I'm sure you do too. So it'll be a wonderful conversation.
I mean, we'll start you off here. I mean, it's sure. As is the usual angry young man courtesy. What's your take? What do you think?
Well, look, I think that first of all, the aid package that went to Ukraine is it's absolutely fantastic. I think it's a long time coming. Speaker Johnson certainly stretched it out to the very last minute when he could have done this without harming Ukraine's defenses. But no, I think it's critical that we get that money to Ukraine. They're an ally of ours. They have signaled their intention to be a part of the West. They want to join NATO. They want to join the European Union. I think in the long run, we should absolutely encourage it. And Vladimir Putin on the 24th of February 2022 gave us the biggest break in the rules-based international European order that we've seen since the Second World War. And I think it's important that we fund our allies so that they can protect against that.
So I guess the question that kind of comes out the gate, specifically with Ukraine, but also as a general thing, as it relates to just any foreign aid, why is it in the interest of American taxpayers to okay their funds being sent abroad, especially when we have very pressing domestic issues?
Well, I think the most important part that we need to remember here is that we're human beings first and Americans second. And absolutely, it's important that our taxpayer dollars go to American interests, but I think that we should also understand the humanitarian aspect of it. We don't want to allow 44 million Ukrainians to be overrun by a despot and a madman in Vladimir Putin, and we don't want them to be subject to a dictatorial regime. But I also think I'd push back a little bit on the idea that it isn't in American interest to have a free Ukraine, for instance, and I know we'll move on to the other countries shortly. Because Putin's Russia right now has, I believe, a population of around 130, 140 million people. Mm-hmm. If they were to be able to fully annex Ukraine, they've got two things. One, their population has just gone up. Their economy has just ballooned by about 30%. And number two, he can claim a victory against the West. And that's almost even more important, because if Putin knows that he's allowed to violate this rules-based international order with little to no repercussions and he's allowed to win, then we don't know what he, and more importantly, what his friends in China and Iran and in the rest of that part of the world will do.
Well, the thing, there's two things kind of within that that I would want to kind of poke at. Firstly, being, you know, looking at what, you know, from a humanitarian perspective,
sure.
You know, as someone who sees a fairly limited role in government, it to me, you know, it's the yes, we care about people. Of course, we care about people. We're kind. We're compassionate, and that's important to assist others where we can. But where the line is drawn between when it is a government action to do so. Not in this case being for its own citizens, but for citizens of other countries abroad.
Yeah.
You know, there is absolutely a place for us to assist our fellow humans that live on this planet with us. There's nothing that separates us intrinsically, but that's where you say, is this a function of government, or is this a function of other entities that have a history of very effective aid and resource sharing when it comes to that sort of stuff, specifically to help the civilians that are most affected in this case. Because irrespective of the position you take in the conflict, both Russians and Ukrainians are facing large issues, humanitarian issues, and a lot of them are just not implicated directly. As citizens, they're just kind of bystanding casualties, which is where, you know, like I absolutely agree that there's a definite need to help these people out. But from where that aid comes, I think, is where we have our split there. I mean, I'm a big believer in non-governmental organizations that operate based on voluntary charity, and that's a whole thing in of itself, but that's kind of where I would go with that. But as it relates to kind of confronting Russia and confronting, you know, the growth of Russian ability to project power, I mean, we've seen a more united Europe that has many calls for a united European army. The European Union itself has been assisting Ukraine. And that's more so where I start to think, you know, why are we still invested in Europe when it's very clear that Europe has the united capability to stand against adversaries such as Russia? Not to say that it's unimportant for us to have a kind of say or stake in the global arrangement of things, particularly because the global economy is something that I would place heavy emphasis on. But as it relates to European defense, we're not in post-World War II or the Cold War, where you have decimated Western European states that just made it through 40 years of war with only 10 years in between. You have fairly well-built, well-funded, and well-equipped Western European armies that are very ready to engage with Russia, two of which being nuclear powers as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think if anywhere is more deserving of our aid and attention, if anywhere, it would be in the Indo-Pacific.
Well, I see what you mean. I just want to take a step back a little bit when you were talking about non-governmental organizations being the best donors of aid. I think in this case, there's an important distinction to be drawn between humanitarian aid and military aid. So I think that military aid, there's not a lot of non-governmental organizations that are going to be able to supply that because, one, an ordinary company is not allowed to go to Lockheed Martin and buy F-35s or buy whatever the case might be.
Can they? But, no. Should they?
Well, that's a different question, I suppose. But no, I think the humanitarian situation is important over that. But I also think that it's important that we enable Ukraine to win the war. And I don't think the humanitarian situation is going to be fixed until the war ends. But we also, for the Ukrainian sake, can't let the war end on Putin's terms. And so I think that the U.S. government and obviously European governments, like you mentioned later, absolutely correctly, are the only entities that actually have it within their capability to arm the Ukrainian government. But when we're talking about European countries, I think, yes, Europe absolutely needs to carry their share of the burden. But a lot of these European countries are. And if you look at the share of countries' GDPs that are going into this conflict, you see that a lot of countries in Europe, particularly Scandinavian countries actually, are putting in more dollars per capita, more dollars per dollar of their economy than the United States is. And at least the way that I look at it, the whole of the democratic world should be operating as a team here. We have our allies in the European Union. We have our allies like Ukraine who aspire to join the European Union. We have our NATO allies, us in Canada and the rest in Europe, and really all sorts and manner of democracies around the world, South Korea, Japan, other allies in Africa and South America. And I don't think that it's right that those in Europe should have to shoulder more of the burden for this war just because it's closer to their home, just because if Putin goes for someone next, it's going to be them.
Well, I think that might be precisely why it's they're given responsibility to kind of ensure that their own backyards are secure. I would say that I'm concerned with a model of the world order which still places the United States as the chief kind of backer of any sort of regional defense. I think that it's important that we instead maybe strengthen ties with our own neighbors and work on regional defense, particularly working with Canada on Arctic defense, especially when our primary adversaries are investing greatly in that. I mean, most obviously Russia, which probably has the largest land border with the Arctic of any nation, but as well as China, who's been investing in the Arctic as well.
Sure.
You know, that's an area to look at. I think that we need to continue to work with countries that are trying to gain larger proximity to us in South America as well, in Latin America.
For sure.
You have Milei in Argentina that's looking to join NATO in some capacity. That I can see more of a rationale for continuing to grow and engage partnerships. But in areas where you have such a well-organized, funded, and equipped military force as Europe, the days in which we are engaging with Europe like that should at this point probably be over. I think that it's important that we maintain strong ties with Europe economically. I think that that is a crucial and key thing to keep in mind. However, to continue to provide for the European defense when they are at a point in their history where they can organize themselves and act in tandem in a way that is comparable to the United States by itself should mean that we can scale back. And where we can scale back, we should scale back. Because, again, we have a lot of pressing things domestically.
Sure, we do. And as do they. But I think that while I agree that Europe should ultimately ramp up their own military capabilities, and I agree that countries in Europe that haven't hit that critical 2% of GDP NATO cap should be hitting it. The fact is they're not there right now. Like at the moment, there's no European army that's ready to, or there's no Europe-wide army that's ready to go into Ukraine if this doesn't work. And the international order whereby the United States has provided security for our European allies, it's worked. I mean, it's worked for almost a century since the collapse of Nazi Germany in 1945. And it, given that it's working, there's no reason to upend it.
Well,
I also want to jump back a little bit at the point about the Arctic. I think we have enough manpower, we have enough money to do both. Our defense budget is something, and correct me if I'm off, it's about $850 billion at the moment.
It is a lot of money.
It is.
That's why I do want to, you know, define
working. It's a
working.
Lot of money.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly a lot of money. I would say that the vast, vast majority of that money isn't going into protecting our European allies. I mean, we just sent, $61 billion to Ukraine, and that's something like 8% of our military budget?
We spend ludicrous amounts of money on our military.
We spend ludicrous amounts of money on our military, but number I guess there's two ways that we can go about this. Number one, spending this much money on our military seems preposterous, and this is when I will admit that I'm among the most liberal Democrats you will find, but I differ a little bit from a lot of Democrats in that I think that we should have a large military budget, because it seems ludicrous until you don't have one, and then when you don't have one, suddenly you need more of one, right? The only reason that we don't have to use our military that much is because our military is absolutely massive. But going back to your point a little bit on the Arctic, we can still put money into that. We are still putting that money into our partnerships with our Canadian friends, partnerships with our other friends in the Arctic region, such as Denmark and those in Europe. But right now, the primary front in this war between the non-democratic Russian regime and the democratic West is not in the Arctic, and it's not in cyberspace. It's on the battlefields of southeastern Ukraine, and so that's where we have to take the fight to them.
Well, you know, I definitely, you know, I would push back and say, you know, like, are we currently spending enough money where we could invest in all of this? Yes.
Absolutely.
But the question is, should we do this? And yes. Can we in the long term? I would say no. This kind of goes back to my primary qualms and concerns with Keynesian deficit spending as a way in which we fund government activities. You know, this will come back to bite us. This is something that I always talk with people about, you know, particularly as we reach $34 trillion in accumulated government debt.
Talk about a ludicrous amount.
Yeah, I mean, that's a large part of that is, and I'll admit, you know, very much driven by Republican presidents who have spent deficit spent heavily on the military, specifically Ronald Reagan. But, you know, as well as during the Obama administration, we did see a large investment in the military as a driver of our debt. But there's only so long we can defer this. There's only so long that you can pass the buck until it hits you. And that's why it's a particular concern of mine that we try to be much more thrifty in how we apply our funds militarily. We have to be wise. We have to be prudent. We have to be aware we are working on borrowed time.
Certainly we are, but I think that Ukraine is just the wrong place to fight that battle. Is our debt too high? Yes. Are we running egregious deficits? Yes. But Ukraine is a tiny, tiny percentage of our overall deficit for this year. And now this is where I'm actually going to agree with you. I don't think that it's sustainable to spend this much money on the Ukrainian defense in the long term. And I wouldn't anticipate putting this much money into Ukraine in 2025, 2026, 2027. Right now, we're at a situation in eastern Ukraine where the front line is essentially frozen. I mean, it hasn't moved in any substantial way since, I think, September of 2022. And so there should absolutely be conversations in the back channels between the United States and Ukraine saying, hey, we're providing this aid for now, but you need to go to the negotiating table with the Russians at some point, and you need to find a diplomatic solution to this. Because, frankly, this war isn't in Russia's interest either. But the reason, I think, that right now Ukraine isn't able to do that is that Putin is playing the waiting game.
Yes.
Because Republicans have so loudly said, and former President Trump has so loudly said, that he thinks that spending money on Ukraine is a waste of money, that if Ukraine were to go to the table with Russia right now, they wouldn't get any kind of good settlement. And that's just because Russia knows that if they wait, there's a very good chance that in January 2025, the President of the United States is a man who wants to pull all funding from the Ukrainians. And if he does that, Russian troops can march right all the way through Ukraine up to the Polish border. And so I think that rhetoric has honestly been the most destructive rhetoric out of any American government personnel on this topic. I think that the best thing to do would be to go to Ukraine, say, look, the United States is fully on board. We want you to win this war. But you're not going to liberate Crimea. You're not going to liberate some of the eastern territories in the Donbass, in Kherson, in Zaporizhzhia. And so you need to go to the table and you need to figure out a solution. Maybe sign an armistice, do what you have to do. And ultimately get yourself out of this, because we're not going to provide you funding forever. But I think actually the fact that the Republicans are being so loud about not wanting to provide funding has put us in a situation where at least for the next 12 months, we're basically hemmed in. We have to.
Yeah, and it ends up being the case, you know, how much in terms of rhetoric does it seem that the United States pulling out would spell doom for Ukraine, so much as, you know, if the United States were to pull back financially, would it actually put them back that much, considering the assistance they're receiving from Europe? But I mean, you know, all that considered, there are other places that the United States did commit to on Saturday. And as we enter our last 10 minutes here,
sure.
I do want to try to, you know, kind of poke and prod a little bit at what we have going on in that respect. You know, we can start off with the hot button one. We have aid to Israel. You know, this is kind of set on the backdrop of massive, and I mean massive, protesting by students at colleges across the country, most notably Columbia, where I'm from. But you also have I mean, back in our own backyard in Schenley Park, there was a large encampment that was speaking very loudly against American investment, be it on the government side or in our institutions that invest or do business with Israel. As someone who describes themselves as a very liberal Democrat.
On occasion. I've got my
moments. On occasion. What's your read on this?
I think some of the protests have been overboard, and there's no doubt about that. I mean, the protests that are saying that Jews should be eradicated from the Middle East, that a Palestinian state should take over all of the territory from the river to the sea, that it's irredentist thinking. It's not going to happen. The state of Israel is there. There are millions of Israelis for which Israel is the only home that they've ever known, and kicking out the Israelis would be just as bad as the Nakba was in 1948. But I hesitate when it comes to sending military aid to Israel. And I don't like saying that because Israel is, like we were talking about, one of these allies that has been with us for so long. And if you ask me at any other time, probably over the course of my lifetime, I would say absolutely we should send them military aid because they're surrounded by countries that don't want them to be there. It's countries that have in the past been prone to attack them, largely unprovoked. And they need to be able to defend themselves. But right now, what's going on in Gaza is, and I'd be curious to get your read on this too, it's horrific. I mean, I think the tally at this point is 35,000 Palestinians dead. A large number of them, absolutely to be true, are Hamas terrorists. But a lot aren't. I mean, the civil infrastructure in Gaza is completely destroyed. Israel has gone in, and they've taken out, I think, 60% of the buildings in northern Gaza. And they've kicked out Hamas, which good for them, but then they haven't occupied the territory because fundamentally it's not clear to me that they care what happened to it afterwards. And because of that, you have wide swaths of territory where there is no government, there are no civil servants, you don't have any sort of humanitarian aid getting through to those areas. It's anarchy and it's famine, and Israel is letting it happen. And at this point, I don't know how we can, in good conscience as Americans, continue to fund a military endeavor that's doing that.
Well, I think that we are both skeptical of aid to Israel and for different reasons.
For different
though.
Reasons, certainly for different
I mean,
reasons.
you are skeptical of aid to Israel because of Israeli military operations. I am skeptical because foreign aid to any country. We are not the same.
For sure. No.
I'm kidding.
No, that's a good way to sum it up. I think whenever you give military aid, you should absolutely think about what those guns and bombs are going to be used for. And in Ukraine, I think they're going to be used for trying to chip away at the Russian front line and maintaining their own defenses. And in Israel, that just at this point isn't what they're being used for.
Well, my thing is, when it comes to how are we perceiving the the actions of Israel, I separate out, you know, my perceived kind of like, where's my support in this war from, should we support them monetarily? So, you know,
sure.
I'll say flat out, should we be supporting them monetarily? No. Just as much as I'd say, should we be supporting Ukraine militarily? No. But in terms of, you know, and this kind of moves a little bit away from the aid discussion, more so to just kind of the conflict right now in Gaza.
I knew we'd get here eventually.
Eventually, you know, all roads lead to Israel-Palestine nowadays.
How long did it take us? 24 minutes to get here?
24 minutes, yeah.
That's not
bad. We did kind of set ourselves up for it. It would really be one quite the feat if we managed to start on something very domestic and then ended up there.
It would, but it probably would have happened anyway, to be honest.
Yeah, honestly.
But alas, here we are. There's
no avoiding. Whether it be kind of indirectly or through very intentional effort of certain people within the country, it pops up anyways. But, you know, kind of just to keep this brief, because I do want to also maybe touch a little bit on Taiwan.
Sure.
Because that's a little bit more future thinking. But when it comes to the position that Israel's in, you know, Hamas is very much a deeply rooted in the region issue. I mean, yeah. You're not talking about the West Bank. The West Bank is a very different story. Gaza is a place where the majority of the legislature there was elected. It was a majority Hamas leadership there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's in any area or system where you have something that's so deeply rooted, like, just think about trying to uproot a plant that's been rooted down somewhere for decades.
Yeah.
You're going to pull up a little dirt with it. And
just, this isn't a little dirt. This is, you're pulling up, like, all the dirt in the forest with it.
Yeah, and it's, listen, are they being slightly indiscriminate, potentially?
That might be the understatement of the century.
You know, it's, I'm sympathetic to the difficulty of attempting to uproot something that is, A, so deeply rooted within the area, and B, a group of people that will use very desperate measures that include putting innocent civilians at risk, in order to keep themselves alive and relevant. And I do very much think that the more that they put civilians in front of them, and the more apparent conflict there is between Palestinians and Israelis, the more Hamas thrives.
I absolutely agree with you there. I would just say two little things about that. One, I don't even know if this war is actually in Israel's long-term strategic interest, because for every Hamas terrorist that they kill, estimates right now are that they're killing 2 to 3 civilians, right? And those civilians have families, right? And those families probably don't have jobs anymore, and they don't have food. And
yeah.
Throughout the course of history, we've seen that when you have a bunch of angry young men, to circle back to the title of the podcast or the show, with no employment and with no means to fend for themselves, and who are angry, I think justifiably in this case angry, they turn to the solution we'd rather they not turn to, which is they oftentimes turn into terrorists. And I think that even if it's not Hamas, we're going to see a resurgence of radical Islamic terrorism in Gaza after this operation is over, maybe 5-10 years down the line.
I don't know if you necessarily agree. We both happen to be in a class that spoke about the motivations of terrorists.
We do happen to be in that class.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, man, do terrorists all just want to be friends?
For context for listeners, Anthony does not think that terrorists all just want
to
be friends.
No. That was actually
to a class.
Someone's gonna clip that, and that's the end of my career.
That's your career shot. Yeah.
Yeah. But I phrased it as a question. Do they? I didn't say I believe. But anyways, aside from that, I mean, it's definitely something worth noting. You know, they're playing, it's a very tough game to kind of untangle themselves from. But in our last Absolutely. 3 minutes here, let's quickly shift gears to Taiwan.
Sure.
You know, potentially an emboldened China. Do we think that, you know, we've been giving support to Taiwan for a while now.
Yeah.
But Are you of the opinion that China is gearing up in any way to assault Taiwan?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in what the Chinese Communist Party says or does, and so I can't say one way or the other, because anyone who makes predictions out of that seems to end up being a fool a year later.
When are they not?
When are they not? It's certainly on the table. I wouldn't be surprised if in the next 5 years China feels emboldened, especially if the U.S. gives up on aid. I do also think one thing that would embolden China, and I don't want to circle all the way back, is if they see that we aren't willing to defend our other allies, and there's Russian troops in Kyiv by the end of 2025. I think that would certainly embolden China.
Yeah, I mean, it's
what do you think?
What do I think? Well, I do believe that, you know, at the end of the day, if there's any region that's most deserving of our material and political attention, it would be the Indo-Pacific. I mean, there's no question that China is the primary adversary currently. While Russia is kind of, you know, still in the game, a little past its prime as a global superpower, but, you know, they're definitely still an area to worry about. But we are pretty much out of time here. I did want to thank you very quickly for joining me today. I'd love to have you on again. This was a good time.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, thank you all for tuning in today. Again, my name is Anthony Cachado. I was speaking today with outgoing Student Senate President of Carnegie Mellon, Kyle Hines. This has been a great time. We will be seeing you all next Thursday. Take care and God bless.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you.
those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the biggest story right now is the way that U.S. news media that claim to be deeply invested in free speech rights are showing that they only mean it sometimes, which means they don't really mean it. The New York Times ran the headline on April 25th, "Pro-Palestinian encampment spread, leading to hundreds of arrests." We are to understand and accept that people peacefully protesting their tuition and tax dollars going to support a genocide that has killed minimally 40,000 people just forces U.S. law enforcement to, whatever their will, truncheon 20-year-olds who are sitting quietly in tents and, if possible, prevent their ever working again. Yes, unapologetic neo-Nazis marching with torches chanting "Jews will not replace us," that was protected speech that we should be as a nation proud of allowing to happen. But the same outlets say students saying they oppose the mass murder of tens of thousands of people is, well, we just can't have that. People looking to corporate news media as bastions of free speech have been wrong for more than a minute, but it's becoming crystal clear now. Information is a public good, journalism is a public service, but media is a business. And the goal of media companies to appease funders and advertisers is going to bring them into conflict with the public and with some journalists who mistakenly thought they were signing up to tell the truth and let the chips fall where they may. We're now seeing the impacts of the reality that corporate media, as well as corporately funded universities, will always side with official power. To present students sitting quietly in tents in protest of genocide as violent terrorists. But the fact that we've been seeing it for decades as corporate media spin narratives about people of color as both violent and lazy, and storylines about the socioeconomic status quo as the best possible option, even as millions of people increasingly recognize that it means a terrible life for them, well, that's what we're up against. But many people at the same time are deeply interested in how different media telling different stories can change our understanding of our past, our present, and our future. Joseph Torres is currently senior advisor for reparative policy and programs at the group Free Press and co-author with Juan Gonzalez of News for All the People. Writer, musician, and communication strategist Colette Watson is with Black River Life, and they both are part of the project Media 2070 that aims to highlight how media can serve as a lever for racial justice and how that includes changing entrenched media narratives about Black people. Their co-authored article, "Repairing Journalism's History of Anti-Black Harm," appears in the Annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. That conversation is coming up on Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. the idea of some form of public communal recognition and redress or reparation for Black Americans for centuries of systemic state-sanctioned harms and their lasting and continuing impact is not new. But our guest's work considers the particular meaningful and sustained harms of news media, of journalistic institutions charged with informing the public without fear or favor that historically and currently have used their special place and power to help drive the oppression of Black and brown people through storytelling and through overt support for racist practices, policies, and ideas. Media 2070 was co-founded by Joseph Torres, who is senior advisor for reparative policy and programs at the group Free Press and co-author with Juan Gonzalez of the crucial book News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. And writer, musician, and communication strategist Colette Watson, who is co-founder of the new group Black River Life. Their co-authored article, Repairing Journalism's History of Anti-Black Harm, appears in the annals of the American Academy of Political and Social Science. And they both join us now by phone from Washington, D.C. and Phoenix, Arizona, respectively. Welcome back to Counterspin, Joe Torres and Colette Watson. All right. Well, crisis of journalism is going to be a phrase that a lot of listeners are familiar with. It's a conversation among people and among philanthropists about how we can save journalism. But it's unclear to us at FAIR, as to many others, if some of those folks in that conversation really understand that corporate journalism, U.S. mainstream so-called journalism has always contained its own poison, and if they are actually willing to address that, or if the goal is more of the same elite conversations that have excluded lots of people, but to do them in a more genteel way than maybe Fox News. So I want to ask you both to start, what is missing from current diagnoses and remedies for what we're told is the crisis of journalism?
Well, I guess I'll kick us off and just say that what's missing is an acknowledgement of our media system's history of harm. And when we talk about that, Joe and I are both co-creators of the Media 2070 project. When Media 2070 talks about this, we often say that similar to our education system and our legal system, which so many people understand as oppressive, our media system is rooted in anti-Blackness and in racism and racial hierarchy. Since the very beginning, when you look at the earliest colonial newspapers, which stayed afloat on the revenues that they were gaining from serving as brokers in the trafficking of enslaved African people by not only posting ads, paid ads for people who had emancipated themselves and run away, but also in the sales of enslaved folks and serving as a broker for those transactions. We know that from that earliest route right on through till now, our system of news, information, journalism, even entertainment media, book publishing, all of those are interconnected and have been rooted in upholding a myth of Black inferiority and have actually perpetuated white supremacy and even white nationalism. So you have to have that in mind whenever you are thinking about journalism and the role it has played in society and the role that we want it to play in the safe, just, multiracial democracy we want in the future. You can't achieve that without acknowledging the history of harm.
I'll add, Colette and I, we began writing this essay over a year ago for this political journal, and Colette, one of the co-creators of 2070, but also the senior director of the 2070 project, and to recent weeks. And what we'll try to do in this essay is to, there is a big debate happening right now about the future of journalism and how it goes. Is it mostly a white-led space?
Mm-hmm.
And the way the discussion has taken place is that democracy is in crisis, and so is journalism. And if we need to save local journalism to save democracy, but as Colette is describing, what does that acknowledge is the role of local newsrooms and local journalism in undermining democracy for Black people and people of color. So we say, when hasn't, in the Me 2030 Project, we're asking the question, they say, when hasn't journalism been in crisis for Black people? Mm-hmm. And when hasn't democracy and these media institutions played a direct role in undermining democracy? In recent years, we have, like, the Los Angeles Times apologizing for being the paper of white supremacy for at least the first 80-plus years. You have the Oregonian saying that it was a paper when it began to try to ensure that Oregonian remained a white state. The Baltimore Sun apologizing for its role in upholding housing segregation and its editorials and the newspapers in support of it. In Baltimore and the Kansas City Star, much to the same. Philadelphia Inquirer apologized. These are all just within recent years. And within the future of journalism debate, there isn't even acknowledgement that, like, this actually happened. Like, these papers have actually apologized. What are we creating that's different?
Right.
Right. How do we address issues of racial hierarchy that these institutions have played a role in undermining democracy for Black folks and for other folks of color? So if we think the current democracy we equated with the right to vote and equal protection rights being, you know, reinstated 60 years ago, local journalism, white dominant news organizations have played a role in undermining democracy, so-called democracy for Black folks and other folks of color, since the get-go, and still are today. And so we're just trying to make an intervention into this debate, because the debate is happening. There's a lot of money being invested in the space. There's a lot of policy work happening, not just with the federal government, local states trying to make an intervention in funding local journalism. And we're afraid we're just going to be replicating the same kind of harms.
Yeah, saving democracy via local journalism seems to mean for a lot of folks just shore up and sustain these local journalistic outlets. There's the missing piece of acknowledgement of the harms that those outlets have done, you know, and it's clear that some people view the whole idea of reparations more broadly as something bad happened to people in the past, and so people that, you know, look like them, to put it crudely, are looking for resources now, you know. But I feel that, particularly if you look internationally and even within this country, that understanding is shifting so that people see not just that harms on individuals but on communities are unending, but also that they see that truth and reconciliation processes that they've seen in South Africa or in Argentina or in Salvador, for example, they involve healing for the whole community. And the starting place, though, is not only about debts unpaid, but it's about acknowledging that there's been a distorted understanding of history, that everyone has been harmed, particularly the people who have been specifically oppressed and harmed. But reparation involves acknowledgement first. It's not a question of throwing money at the issue. There is an acknowledgement and a truth-telling that has to happen first. That's my rambling. You can call that a question, but you know what I'm saying, that it's not enough to say, oh, we did a bad thing, as some papers are doing. You know, back in the 18-dickety-doo, we wrote a bad thing, but we're sorry about it. That's not what is being called for.
Absolutely. And I think one key part of this is really seeking to broaden not only our sense of journalism and its history and its future, but our sense of what repair and reparation involve. When we created the Media Reparations Project, we also sought to really spread the understanding that reparations has to be a holistic process. We took a lot of inspiration and leadership from people who have been fighting for reparations ever since emancipation. Mm-hmm. And when we're speaking to, you know, what reparations is all about, often in community, people sort of reduce it to this idea of a check. You know, as you just said, Janine, it's not this one-time apology or even a one-time payment. You know, it has to be holistic and understood as a process, a journey rather than a destination. And speaking of folks, we took inspiration from, you know, our friends at Liberation Ventures, which is a reparations organization. They describe reparations as a comprehensive process that involves reckoning, acknowledgement, accountability, and redress. And when you're talking about the realm, you know, of journalism, Joe mentioned a couple of different platforms and papers that have issued apologies and sort of stopped there. And we know that this entire conversation around the future of journalism is one that should really inform what next after the apology and after the investigation. What is it that newspapers and other media platforms can and should be doing to rectify the different types of harm, you know, that they have wrought, whether that be sensationalistic headlines and false headlines that led to racial terrorism and lynchings, whether that be the ways that even to this very day, it's nearly impossible for journalists to sustain careers because of the toxicity in newsrooms. Right. And, you know, there's so much more that we could name, but it has to be an ongoing process that's engaged with people who have been directly impacted and defined by community.
When we're talking about these papers, we talk about narratives, right? And narratives are a political tool. Narratives are used by those in power in these media companies to uphold racial hierarchy. And uphold racial hierarchy means, like, not just within their newsrooms, but within the society as well. So these newsrooms are playing an outsized role in shaping what local communities look like. And we talked about the example of segregation in Baltimore and wealth creation and wealth death and all that. And so these media companies are playing a role in reinforcing the racial hierarchies throughout each community they serve, whether it's schooling, housing, just name it, right? They're playing a role in shaping the society with their narratives. And because these powerful media owners are political players within the society in which they exist. And so the idea of acknowledgement is just the beginning, as Colette is saying, and you're talking about too, Janine. It has to be like, how do we get to redress? Because what's happening, they reinforce structural racism in our society in all these various ways, as I mentioned. And for us, we should focus on the media part because structural racism also exists in the media system. So for us to be able to tell our own stories, right, to own our own institutions in order to fight for racial justice, for reparations, the system is going to have to change too for our own communities to be able to own and control the creation and distribution of their own narratives. And so this is what we're fighting for. If we can shift how media functions, I think there's a better chance or a greater chance that we could actually address all the other underlying causes that are affecting society that newsroom play a role in promulgating, you know, in all these different ways.
Joe, I think in addition to changing the way that media has perpetuated hierarchy and harm in society, this discussion around repair and really reframing the way we understand the future of journalism conversation is also an invitation to actually save journalism. And I think that there's a lack of understanding of the fact that journalism being white dominated and being steeped in a worldview of Black inferiority and a worldview of racial hierarchy has very much been a part of why we find this industry to be faltering at this point. It's policies and culture and so much, but it's all grounded and rooted in journalism's early rootedness in racism. And what I mean when I say that is we talk a lot and we hear a lot about community trust and sort of community engagement and different things about how audiences perceive the field and how they're willing to even maybe invest in it, whether that be investing time or what have you. But there's a deep distrust of journalism across communities of color because there is a deep history of harm. And then there are so many journalists of color who have tried to be truth tellers and tried to embody, you know, the true purpose of journalism in holding power to account, who have found it next to impossible to do that because of toxicity inside dominant and corporate newsrooms and because of the underfunding and underinvestment in Black serving and other serving sort of like different religious minorities and other groups, LGBTQIA+ community. You know, all of the newsrooms that serve these marginalized identities have been woefully under-resourced by the public sector and by philanthropy when compared to their white counterparts. And so whether it be on the part of journalists of color or communities of color, you know, there's this deep divide and this sense that the main kind of dominant media doesn't care about our lives, right, and doesn't think of us when they're talking about journalism and democracy. And when I talk about that to people, I like to always say there's two words you can add on in the ways you're talking about these issues of the future of journalism, that'll take you so much further than where we usually go. And those two simple words are for who? Mm-hmm. Journalism for who? Mm-hmm. You know, democracy for who? Mm-hmm. Who are we serving? Carla Murphy talks about multiple mainstreams and thinking of the future of our media system as one that is steeped in serving the information needs of just so many different kinds of folks and serving the creation of conditions for different kinds of justice. And I think that when you begin to think about who we are wanting to serve and whose needs we're centering, that opens up so much more opportunity and so much more oxygen around what journalism can be. But we can't get there if we just talk about it the same old way and really are using, you know, legislation and policy ideas and philanthropy to shore up the status quo.
Absolutely. I just want to say that for some folks, this might sound like out of pocket, like it might sound like a new idea. But the truth is, this is drawing on roots. The Kerner Commission, just to say one thing, folks remember, but they remember it as saying media should do better by Black people. And that's not what it said. It said news media are failing everybody and failing the future with their white-centric perspective. You know, it challenged the whole thing. So there are historical roots that you're pulling on here. There are traditions here. There are examples here. It's not out of whole cloth. You know, there is something to connect to here that gives strength to the ideas that we're putting forward here.
Yes. I mean, Joe Torres, for my money, is one of the most incredible researchers yep. and minds that we have in this field. And I really encourage folks to dig into the essay, because throughout these pages, as you're describing, Janine, there are just so many examples from throughout history. A lot of people don't realize, for instance, that the earliest FCC broadcasting licenses were issued during the Jim Crow era, and so to white men only.
Right.
And so that leads us to the present day, where we have a media system where just a very scant percentage of our TV and radio are Black owned. And we could go on and on, because, like I said, Joe has just done exhaustive effort here in making sure that we have the evidence when we talk about this.
Yeah.
Joe, I know you don't like getting credit, but
you know, when you have to, you have to, because voids need to be filled, frankly. Mm-hmm. It's not a conversation that folks have it rhetorically. I bet there's things missing here, but they don't know what's missing. And that's why they need work like you're doing.
I appreciate, you know, Colette knows I don't like that, you know, but like, I appreciate it. And one of the things we learned in putting this essay together 4 years ago when we launched this essay was that in Chicago, there was a commission formed to study the causes of the upheaval in Chicago race riot. And it came out with a report in 1922, where they devoted a significant portion of the report to the media's role, the white media's role in fomenting this. And so here was an example of a multiracial commission that said, hey, the media, especially the white media, played a role in this racial so-called unrest, the violence that happened in this city. And then you talk about the Kerner Commission, Janine, and then 50 years later after that, what we have, like in 2020, the uprisings and all this, folks within journalism circles saying, hey, like calling on their newspapers or their media institutions to address racism in their own newsrooms. And one of the things that's really understudied, it's really an unbelievable example to me, like in 1964, the Community Relations Service was created. It became soon after that an agency with the Department of Justice, and the peacekeepers, the mediators, right? They realized early on, within the first few years mm-hmm. of its founding, that a major obstacle to integrating our society, to people adhering to Brown versus Board, was journalism with the media. And that they had to try to not just integrate the media systems, but they started to hold conferences for Black and Brown folks and for people in to how to fight license challenges against broadcasting. They brought in experts who came in and taught activists how to challenge broadcast license. This was within the Department of Justice, and that part of its mission was basically not funded anymore following the Nixon administration, right? Here, the government agency within the Department of Justice realizing that the biggest obstacle to people adhering to the decision of Brown versus Board and integrating our society was the media. That's another indictment, as you're saying, about the Kerner Commission a little over 50 plus years ago. And so we're still dealing with this. You know, we're still dealing that we don't have our own institutions, that the FCC, the first chairman of the FCC was the former chief justice for the Mississippi Supreme Court. Of course, like black and brown people wouldn't get licenses during this era, you know, because it's all been baked in, right? It's all been baked in. And since then consolidation has only put things out of reach for us in more compounding the lack of wealth that exists in our community because of the extraction of a nation's political project, right?
Absolutely. Well, I'll just ask finally, what do folks who think media reparations, that's going to change what I get to see and hear? Is that going to restrict what I get to see and hear? Is that going to police what I get to see and hear? That's not the conversation that we're talking about having, right?
Absolutely. I mean, Joe, I will defer to you.
Well, I mean, we talk about abundance.
Yeah.
There should be abundance of voices out there, right? And it's like there's no reason we have such a concentrated media system where you have a few companies. And, you know, here we're talking about, you know, the cable broadcast model, for example, which, you know, television is still making a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
you know, and news is driving that. So while we're talking about so-called crisis in journalism, which is, we're talking about normally print media, broadcast media is trying to get in action, too, and try to take the legislative effort to get their piece of the pie while they're making a lot of money, right, broadcast stations.
Mm-hmm.
And so, no, it's like, how can we have abundance of Black and BIPOC media outlets out there that serve in local communities with providing a variety of perspectives? And we're fighting for not only the variety of perspectives, but also a tether to sever the health and well-being of the community, right? Not out there for bottom-line profits, right, and to maximize profit.
Mm-hmm.
How can we have abundance of this? The idea of it's not what's being taken away from you, it's what's going to be added to your life to ensure the health and well-being of the community. How's it serving the wealth, health and well-being of the need of people in local communities and local society? And this is the role in which media can play an instrumental role in ensuring that, in advocating for that, or it too often plays a detrimental role, as we see, in taking away those kind of rights that allow people to have their basic needs served, you know, in housing, in food, in schooling, right? And so, no, the vision for an abundance of media outlets that are well-funded, there's no reason why we can't do that. We invest so little in this country into media, and especially in public media, and we can create something different and something better.
That's beautiful. All right. We've been speaking with Joe Torres from Free Press and Colette Watson at Black River Life. You can tap into the work that we've been talking about at mediareparations.org. Joseph and Colette, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR. We're online at fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after.
Everyone, this is Jesse, a.k.a. Dubmatix, the Renegade Rocker from Toronto, Canada, and you are listening to the one, the only, the mighty WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Now the only time